This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
I'm Rachel Hampton, and you're listening to ICYMI, in case you missed it, Slate's podcast about internet culture. And today, we're doing a little throwback to a different time. Do you remember when y'all used to just tune in and hear me monologue for 5 to 7 minutes? Don't you miss that? Well, lucky for you, you get to relive those glory days because our beloved Candace is out in the world brokering connections with Audi and Tempur-Pedic for us. We salute you. But today is not just a throwback because I'm back in the solo host chair, but because almost exactly a year ago, we did a very similar episode. That's right. It is now time for our newly annual Love is Blind recap. And we are making this annual not just because I'm obsessed with this show or because Netflix is a streaming company and therefore of the internet, but because, as I said this time last year, the internet is basically the secret producer of this show, as it is for most reality TV shows. And I'm not just blowing hot air. I'm not the only one who thinks that. Because today, I'll be joined by none other than Jonquilin Hill, reality TV scholar and reporter and host of Vox's policy and politics podcast, The Weeds. As you'll hear her say later in the episode, the fourth wall constantly being broken by contestants' awareness of the internet is the unspoken cast member of this season of Netflix's mega hit dating reality series. But first, we got to set the table a little bit. We got to put the pieces on the chessboard so we know what's happening. Love is Blind first aired in a stroke of almost incredibly lucky and uncanny timing in 2020, when the concept of getting engaged to someone you'd never met before seemed a little less outlandish because it felt like the world was crashing in around all of us. Do you remember that? That's also the year that I wrote about the show. And once again, I will be plagiarizing myself because I work smarter and not harder. So this is how Love is Blind works. 15 men and 15 women are separated into dormitories and at first are only allowed to communicate with each other from isolated pods that prevent them from seeing who they're talking to. The prize in this case is not money, but marriage, which only serves to make the entire, quote, experiment uncannier. Produced by Kinetic Content, which is also behind Married at First Sight, and barely hosted by Nick and Vanessa Lachey, Love is Blind aims to suss out whether or not love transcends such nebulous concepts as race, age, and physical appearance by having couples get engaged without ever laying eyes on each other. The first few episodes are claustrophobic in how crowded they are. Much like The Bachelor, it's unclear early on who we're meant to focus on as viable couples, so all the entertainment value comes from watching people attempt to flirt through a wall. In the span of 4 weeks, couples are expected to move in together, meet each other's families, and plan a wedding. A majority of these lab hatch engagements don't end, and I do. So 6 seasons later, and I would say that it's safe to say that Love is Blind is one of Netflix's reality TV tentpoles. According to a user on Reddit, because that is the only way to get Netflix viewership numbers, this most recent season of Love is Blind was the most watched even before the reunion episode aired on March 13th. As of March 13th, the show had been streamed for a total of 207.8 million hours. I'm gonna be honest, at least 100 of those hours were just me. And as a dedicated viewer of both the show and of the online discourse of Sparks, I would say that number feels pretty accurate. The last time we covered the show, the subreddit had about 500,000 members, and it's since ballooned to 1 million in the past 11 months. For reference, the subreddit for The Bachelor, which has been airing since 2002, has just over 350,000 members. And to me, the size of the subreddit makes sense because what became clearer and clearer over the course of this season is that contrary to the cast list, the third host and arguably most important host of Love is Blind is Reddit. I will explain more what I mean by that later, but first I want to take y'all through these couples that are now permanent members of the rotating cast of characters in my head. I feel like I know these people. I'm going to go in ascending order of complication, as in who has the most complicated relationship. I will be spoiling the season, so if you do not want to know what happens, come back to this episode after you finish watching. One last time, I am about to spoil the sixth season of Love is Blind. If you don't want to know, come back later. All right, so first up, we have Amy and Johnny, who I've seen described as the perfect embodiment of the golden retriever boyfriend and black cat girlfriend trope. And I would honestly agree. I think the show was made for certain people to meet, and some of those people are these two. Their wedding was one of the sweetest things I've ever seen. It was a marriage of not just two people, but two families in a way that I've seen in real life, but is rarely shown on reality television. Then there's Brittany and Kenneth, who are uncomplicated in that they broke up relatively early after the honeymoon, but the denouement of their relationship is one of the most contested mysteries of this season because from a viewer perspective, it really seems like Kenneth got access to his one true love after the honeymoon, his cell phone, and then decided to break up an engagement for that. We don't have any real answers, but they weren't meant for each other, so it's okay. Now on to the real players of this season. The most frustrating and thus perhaps the most realistic couple of this season was Amber Desiree, or AD, and Clay. I spent hours talking about these two in my free time. And here, AD, I would say, is a light upon this earth. And I don't say that lightly. She is smart. She is beautiful. She is talented. She seems like such a great person. But she also, unfortunately and self-admittedly, is a Captain Fix-a-ho. And Clay is a hoe that needs to be fixed. We have all seen this story before. Some of us have been in this story before. It ends exactly how you expect it to, but the journey there is wild. Now, onto our love triangles, because yes, there are multiple. The messiest, I would say, takes place between Jeremy, Sarah Ann, and Laura. Jeremy, who for some reason spells his name with an A in it, which is the least of his crimes, courts both of these women in the pods and then proposes to Laura. But as soon as they come back to real life, Sarah Ann, who describes herself on the show as a patriot, DMs Jeremy on Instagram, and the two stay out until 5 a.m. one night, allegedly just chatting. Jeremy is still engaged to Laura at this point, so Laura is upset, as is her right, and confronts him after this night in a scene of detective work that will live rent-free in my head for the foreseeable future.
You're denying leaving the bar.
I don't want to talk about that right this second.
You don't want to talk about it this second?
No.
Just admit that you lied then.
I'm not going to lie to you about it.
You weren't at the parking lot of Lost and Found. Don't share your fucking location if
that's
you don't
bullshit.
Want me to check it at 5 a.m.
That's bullshit.
Great.
I parked. There's Lost and Found. Then there's an alley that cuts back there.
You weren't even in South End. You were north of Uptown, which is where Sarah Ann lives.
And our final love triangle is, I would say, actually more of a square, a diamond, a rhombus. This is all I remember for geometry. I can't go any further. The main players are Jimmy and Chelsea, who are In the parlance of self-diagnosis TikTok, a classic example of a couple where one person has an anxious attachment style and the other one has an avoidant attachment style. In the pods, Jimmy's also courting Jessica, who is a single mom of a 10-year-old who he undeniably has a much stronger emotional connection to, but Jimmy's 27 and not ready to be a stepdad in a month, which is very fair. Does it take him too long to say that? Yes. Meanwhile, Chelsea's being courted by mullet muscle bro Trevor, who went from hero to villain in a heel turn so fast, it actually stunned me, a hardened viewer of this content. Jimmy and Chelsea end up getting engaged, and their relationship is rockier than the Swiss Alps. From a reality television perspective, it's beautiful. From a relationship perspective, therapy is recommended. So those are our couples. Those are our players. But like I said, I actually think the most important character of this show is Reddit, from whom the producers of Love is Blind have clearly been taking notes. And luckily for y'all, my monologue is now over, and I will now be proving that theory with none other than Jonqueline Hill, a reporter and host of Vox's Policy and Politics podcast, The Weeds. We will be back together after a short break. Hi, y'all. If you love our podcast, then please consider subscribing to Slate Plus. When you subscribe to Slate Plus, you get no ads on any Slate podcasts, including this one. You will also be supporting the show. ICYMI would not be possible without the support of Slate Plus subscribers. You will also get bonus segments or episodes on shows like Slow Burn, Amicus, Working, The Waves, Culture Gap Fest, so many shows. And you'll also get unlimited reading on the Slate website, which means you'll get access to every single article and advice column on Slate without ever hitting the paywall. To sign up, just visit slate.com/ICYMI+. That is slate.com/ICYMI+.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
And I'm back with Jonqueline Hill, reporter and host of Vox's Policy and Politics podcast, The Weeds. As longtime listeners of the show will know, JQ is also a scholar of the only field of study worth funding, reality television. Last time we were on the show, JQ, almost a whole year ago, we were dissecting one of Netflix's biggest failures, which was the live reunion for the fourth season of Love is Blind. And I'm not going to lie, I kind of thought that was going to be the end of it. They were going to keep making it. I was going to keep watching it, but the failed live reunion followed by the clown car that was season 5 really had me in doubt that they would ever make a good season again. But I am a woman who is willing to admit when she's wrong, and I was wrong because season 6 blew my expectations out of the water. I haven't gasped this much at a TV show in years.
Yeah, they ate that. They ate it.
They ate it. But before we dive into what exactly happened in this most recent season to change my mind and seemingly yours, I want to check in with you, JQ. I want to hear about your journey over the past year. How did you feel about the fifth season that took place in Houston? Were you excited for the sixth season? Were you just like, I'm going to watch it, obviously.
I mean, here's the thing. I went in with really low expectations.
Yeah.
Just because, like, the Houston season was... it was so chaotic. And I am a chaos agent, but it was chaotic, but not in a fun and good way.
Yes.
And so maybe this season seems so good because there was drama, there was breakups, and there was a successful love story that you rooted for. And you kind of have to have all those things happening simultaneously to have a good season of this show.
You're entirely right. It brought everything that I needed. I laughed, I cried, I gasped. Before the break, I gave a brief description of the couples and love triangles and parallelograms that made up this season. And I'm going to give my absolute last warning. There will be spoilers ahead for the rest of this episode. The sixth season just finished airing. We're taping this episode the day after the reunion episode drops. So we've seen everything. We've seen the tape. We're strapped in. Let's get started. JQ, what did you think? Highlights, lowlights, favorite couples, moments you had to walk away from the TV because you were so stressed out.
Wow. Okay. Highlights. If we're going with positive for highlights, Amy and Johnny, they were cute. And also they proved something that I believe, which is at least in the beginning, it shouldn't be hard. Like everything for them is easy. The biggest thing they had to overcome was whether or not to buy a basal thermometer. Like that was their biggest challenge. And it had an easy solution. Buy the thermometer. You'll be fine.
The way Johnny did not understand how a vasectomy worked, and we watched this man discover how a vasectomy works on television was incredible.
It's just like, again, if that is their biggest issue, great.
Yeah.
So you got that. I will say the unspoken, maybe even other cast members, was the broken fourth wall. Like, yes. These are people, you are so far into seasons, and I think we're just so far into the experiment that is reality TV, it is now impossible to divorce the fact that, oh, this will be on TV. Oh, it's getting an edit. People were obsessed with their edit, and it did not go the way they thought. As far as lowlights, I mean, there's so many. The amount of villains, Jeremy, Sarah Ann, Laura, wow. At first, I was honestly anti-Laura because I'm like, girl, like, let him wear his Hawaiian shirts. Like, nobody's perfect. Turns out Jeremy's a monster. And so is Sarah Ann. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, went in thinking Jimmy would be the villain. Turns out Chelsea, you know, people talk about, oh, self-sabotage. Oh, yes. XYZ. That was like an instance where I was like, oh, this is what this actually is. I'm yes. seeing this happen. Clay and AD. AD is not strict. And we saw with AD and Clay, what happens when you're not strict?
Let's get into AD and Clay, because I actually think they, in a lot of ways, symbolize why this season was so good. As you're talking about the fourth wall, they're all so highly aware of the way that they're presenting themselves. And these are two people who very clearly are aware that social media fame is part of being on this show. AD was a former professional dancer for the New England Patriots and the Charlotte Hornets. Clay had never seen the show before, which means that his only frame of reference is this is a platform on Netflix off of which to launch myself. Which in the worst version of the show could make them just two influencers talking to each other. But it was the opposite. There was something very real happening. Perhaps the realest thing I've seen on the show.
It really felt like a microcosm of like Black dating and the Black dating scene, at least in major cities. Just everything from, you know, these are two people in their 30s, theoretically should be ready to settle down. Him having his damage and being like, oh, I'm not ready. Him constantly telling her he's not ready, but like still sort of stringing her along. Her ignoring the red flags just because she is so ready. Her, after it breaks apart, like realizing like, oh my gosh, like, why not me? I thought it was my turn. It also reminded me of Risa Tisa.
Yes. Yes.
Like there's this narrative of like, oh, it'll happen. It'll be your turn. And so like you get so excited for your turn, or that it's like, oh, it's finally happening. Like all my friends were right. Like the stories were right. Like it just had to be like my turn. And then it's like, just kidding. That gut punch. Also with AD, her instincts were right. Like when she was like, Matt is a no. When Clay first asked what she looked like, that was the first red flag to be like, hey, sorry, I actually can't do it this. And it would have saved her a lot of heartache, but she ignored it and was like, maybe we can work through it. Maybe we can get past through it. And I know what that's like. What makes me mad is when someone treats you badly and then they're like, wow, I need to be a better person. And it's like, we should not have to be canon events in someone else's story. He hurt her on his road to becoming self-actualized. Mm-hmm. And like, that is not cool or worth it.
It's not, but it's so real.
Yeah.
Is the thing. The thing about Love is Blind and the way that it portrays Black women is that largely up until this season, I have been refreshingly surprised by the fact that Black women, when they are main characters on the show, get a pretty straightforward love story.
Yeah.
Lauren and Cameron, Tiffany and Brett. And then I watched the season and I was like, and that is actually what happens in the real world. Seeing the way it unfolded, along with seeing the kind of generational way it unfolded, seeing their parents interact with each other, made me think about the fact that both of these people are clearly on the show for a reason other than getting married. They both brought something to this show in their like extreme self-awareness and lack of self-awareness, like simultaneously, that produced, I think, one of the best moments of reality television I've ever watched, which is a conversation had between Clay's mom and Clay's dad after Clay says no to AD at the altar.
Part of what he is struggling with, he struggles with a marriage.
With commitment? Okay.
With a marriage.
Okay.
Is it sacred?
Mm-hmm.
Do you honor? He struggles with that. And all of those emotions and twisted feelings, he took that to the altar. And a lot of that stems from things that you have to explain and then apologize. Don't make excuses, just apologize so that closure can be had. But the marriage thing, the commitment, he struggles with that. He's like, I know you stayed, Mom, but there's things that I saw that I should not have saw or been in a position, you know. And kids, when they grow up and they see things, it's like, you know, is marriage for real? Or is marriage something that you get into and you lie and you deceive? And he took a lot of that to the altar with his decision.
I think accountability is the big thing because she held his father accountable. And with Clay, I get like, oh, generational trauma, XYZ. But at a certain point, you're an adult and you get to decide, like, you saw the patterns, you have the opportunity to break them. What are you going to do?
You're right, is the thing. And that is, again, why I am, I guess, focusing on Clay and AD so much, because I think they really represent what good reality television is.
It's reality. Like, that is the realest piece of reality television I have seen in so long.
Yes, yes. I want to read a bit from a Vulture article that said, Clay's parents are Love is Blind at its best. It goes, quote, Love is Blind can't always find or orchestrate scenes like this, partly because the process of filming people can make this level of honesty hard to come by, but also because it's unusual to find someone as cogent as Clay's mother. When Love's Blind is really working, though, it's a show about why people are together and why they fall apart. And that's so true. And I think this season really kind of got that in a way that the other few seasons haven't. And I think it's because of a theory I had the last time we talked, which is that the fourth season was the first season where you can kind of see the allure of social media as a motivating factor for the contestants. Because the first season of the show hadn't been picked up by a production company. The next two seasons were filmed in tandem. So there was a little bit of what is this? What will it do for me? Versus the kind of established cast member to influencer pipeline that exists for a lot of other shows. And the next two seasons, as in 4 and 5, I think was the moment you saw the production company just not know what to do with the fact that all of their contestants are being influencerified. But this season, I really think they struck the perfect balance of finding people who know that this show could launch their career, who are hyper aware of the edit, who are saying things like, America is watching. But also people who, despite that, still want to find love on this show. People who aren't so cynical as to believe, they're like, I could get a career and a husband? Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those, both can exist. Like, there's always the here for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
But it's like, what if you want Instagram followers and a man? And Lauren is kind of a great example of that.
Right. And Lauren is from the very first season of Love is Blind. She married Cameron and they're very much still together and very much considered the first couple of the Love is Blind fandom.
Yeah, she was kind of an influencer before, got more followers and like fell in love, is still happily married all these years later. And I think production is so aware of the audience, yes, in a way most shows refuse to be. Like, you could even tell at the reunion, oh, you guys are on Twitter and Reddit. You know what the audience is saying. You know what they found. You know the questions they want to ask. Like, everyone is extremely self-aware, mm-hmm, on this show. But because everyone is so self-aware and no one is pretending not to be self-aware, that in turn creates very real dynamics.
Yes. Yes. I noticed a kind of similar dynamic on the most recent season of The Bachelor, and I ascribed that level of authenticity to Gen Z, where they're so used to being on camera. And because of the way TikTok prioritizes authenticity in air quotes over the kind of polish of Instagram, there's a way that I think people who come up online present themselves in a realer way than previous contestants did. And I think it's made the show a lot better. But I also think the producers have stopped trying to micromanage. They allowed people to talk about the edit on camera, which is usually stuff that gets cut out because we want to pretend that we're watching a documentary and not a very well-produced television show.
Yeah. Matthew's America is Watching. It's like, that's weird to say.
So weird to say.
But also, like, at the reunion, it came to light that Jeremy said, like, well, at least I'm getting a better edit than Jimmy. And he wasn't. Like, everyone thought Jimmy was going to be the villain of the season because he was in sort of the biggest love triangle. That was, yeah, not the case. And it's like, the more you try to manipulate the edit, producers know that. Like, exactly, the more you try to manipulate it, they will manipulate you. Because at the end of the day, they are the people in control of the edit.
You can tell when the producers like contestants or when the contestants are doing what producers want. Like Brittany, you can tell she was just a sweet girl who was giving quotes to the camera and was clearly there for, quote, the right reasons. And the producers were like, here, have the best edit of the season. Everyone's going to love you. But people who were too aware of what was going on, like Jeremy, and who tried to not only trick his fiance, but trick the producers, were absolutely murdered, deservedly, by their edit. There's this way in which hyper-awareness just kind of loops back into cluelessness that I think Jeremy really encapsulated. But speaking of him, I want to talk about how active the cast has been online this past season, including Jeremy's ex-fiance's family. Yes, I did just say that. But first, we need to take a short break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
And we're back. Something we talked about last year was how many of the cast took to social media to defend themselves between when the season started airing and when the reunion dropped. And honestly, I feel like in comparison to what came out this season between episode drops, that was small potatoes. People were just apologizing for on-screen behavior. This season, whole storylines emerged on social media in between episode drops that then became storylines on the reunion. Before we dive into those storylines, were you like me? Were you also lurking on the subreddits?
Oh, absolutely. I would watch each episode and then be like, let me go to the mega thread. Let me get on the Reddit, click the sticky, go on the mega thread, find the one for this day.
Mm-hmm.
I was tweeting. I was looking through the hashtags. I was like, what are we thinking as it was happening? I saw TikToks, you know, just scrolling through, and it's like, here's screenshots from like so-and-so's ex.
You guys, Trevor also was in a serious relationship when he went to film the show, and I have receipts. Been dating this girl since 2022, and he broke up with her 2 weeks before the show aired. Now, I know y'all love Teddy Bear Trevor, so before you hop in my comments and say this is not true, let me show y'all the receipts.
I was clocked into all the supplemental material. Yes, I did the extra reading over the summer.
And something that kept coming up on the Reddit that I'm curious if you agree with is that people thought that spacing out the episodes in the way that the show does, which is to drop three episodes on a Wednesday and then keep dropping a few episodes every Wednesday for about a month, ended up spoiling the season because the cast kept responding in between episodes. I think it made the show better. But I wanted to know what you think about the fact that we found out Trevor had a secret girlfriend the entire time he was on the show, or that a relative of Jeremy's ex-fiance posted a photo of him right before the show dropped, or Sarah Ann filming from Jeremy's house in between the show airing and the reunion.
The most controversial thing about me is that in most cases, I'm pro-spoiler. Like, for me, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. So me knowing what happened isn't going to ruin it for me, because I still want to see how we got there, what happened, etc. So I was into it. Although I do understand people who are like, I don't want to know anything. I do understand like why that feels like a spoiler, but I think it does adds almost to the community aspect of it too. Yeah. Because it's like, okay, the audience is also aware. Like everyone in this equation is aware of what this is.
I think it kind of harkens back to, unfortunately, what made the Kardashians so effective, which is that in between seasons of the Kardashians, all of this stuff would come out about what the family was doing. You would find out that, I mean, Kim was held hostage. You would find out that people got divorced. And the point of the season wasn't for you to find out about the events, but to find out how they felt about the events as they were taking, because you knew cameras were up as this was happening. And so they created their own feedback loop. And so when I see people saying they should keep all the cast members from doing interviews, they should ban cast members from posting online, I just think to myself, you don't understand what makes a hype cycle. Because as I'm reading about all of these things, as I'm spending hours on the subreddit every single day trying to figure out what people are finding out, I'm thinking, is this going to be at the reunion? How are they going to respond to this? And it only made the reunion better.
The difference between this season and season four were the tech issues. Like, they tried to do it live and it was just not working. Also, the line of questioning was just kind of bad. Like, Nick and Vanessa, it just felt like they were so out of touch with what the audience was thinking about the show. And for the first time ever, it was like, oh, we are all on one accord. And even the audience was weighing in. Like, the difference when Laura popped up on screen versus when Sarah Ann walked in, and the audience reaction.
The live audience was a phenomenal touch. And they figured it out. They took notes, which happens so rarely with reality television. But those producers were lurking in the subreddit because they taking questions straight from the subreddit threads.
Straight.
They were reading text messages from contestants on stage that had leaked, like Andy Cohen. The moment that they read Trevor's text to his girlfriend.
Screenshots came out on the internet, which were allegedly between you, Trevor, and the girlfriend that you had at the same time that you were participating in this experiment.
Yes, in fact, you were texting her as you were traveling here and as soon as you left the pods. We actually have the text, so let's go ahead and take a look.
Show the receipt.
I love you so much, honey. I'm excited for it, but more excited to get back to you after and start our life together.
She responded with, did you land?
Trevor responded, just did. Then, skipping to when you left the pods, you again wrote, do you still love me?
She says, pumpkin, I'm crying.
Trevor then says, can I call you in 30 minutes?
She said, I missed you so much.
Trevor wrote, I love you more than anything in this world, and I'm going to marry you.
She says, yes, call me. I can't wait.
Trevor says, I hope you know how much I love you and had to pretend that this wasn't real life to say anything I said.
She responds with, it's okay, pumpkin.
And you know he wasn't ready to hear that. And there is a 30-second pause.
Now, Trevor, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, me
certainly
too.
A lot to unpack there. I think not only Vanessa and I, but everyone on this stage would love to hear what you have to say about that.
Nah, say it with your chest.
Don't get quiet now.
Thank you.
Don't get quiet now.
You cannot script this shit. Like, the reunion revealed a lot. And honestly, I think Laura came out of this the best of anyone besides Amy and Johnny, who were just happy. Because Laura got her licks in. Laura got to confront both Jeremy and Sarah Ann on camera. Laura had one of the best moments of detective work I have seen on screen.
Like, I need to get kick rocks with open-toed shoes tattooed somewhere on my body. I was just like, like, I heard that and I like literally started levitating.
Laura's one-liners were so good. And I also think it's because she was hyper aware of the edit. She was like, you know what? I will not be made to be a fool. I will not be made out to be one of these girls who knew what their man was doing and then handled this quietly off camera. We're on camera, baby. This is my real life. This is your real life. This is not a game to me. They found the perfect people for this season. And again, the reunion, they've learned from their mistakes. They asked tough follow-up questions. I feel like Andy Cohen maybe gave Vanessa and Nick a class. I have very few notes, but what were your favorite parts? I feel like they mentioned the internet like 10 times in the first 30 minutes.
Laura's appearance and also like everyone getting into Sarah Ann and Jeremy and being like, yeah, nah, this wasn't it. For the most part, Clay and AD getting into their stuff was very good. The most confusing / least favorite part, although there wasn't a lot to get to, was Kenneth and Brittany.
Yeah.
Because it was short and it needed to be short, but it was just like, wait, what's going on? Also, I will say it was nice seeing the couples because that's the other thing too. The kind of critique there's been is like, oh, there haven't really been any real couples since like Lauren and Cam. Like out of all these seasons, there have been 11 couples who have gotten married. 9 are still married. Like, I think that's probably a better rate than most of America. So, like, the thing is, it could be, like, a legitimate way to find love. And, like, finding love is a very difficult / impossible thing right now. So, like, yeah, maybe we all should go on Love is Blind.
Okay, my last question is kind of a big one because I feel like we can't talk about Love is Blind without talking about Renee Poche, who is currently suing Netflix after being penalized $4 million for breaking her NDA, allegedly. Renee was in season 5, which was the Houston season, the dark-sided season, to be quite honest.
Yes.
But her scenes ended up getting cut almost entirely out of the show, despite the fact that she made it to the altar. Renee alleges that her partner on the show regularly berated her, solicited amphetamines, threatened crew members, and According to the girlies on the subreddit, allegedly, the reason that the scenes got cut is because her partner threatened to harm himself if they aired his scenes.
Oh my
allegedly,
God.
Allegedly. But Renee speaks candidly about her experience in interviews after season 5 wrapped, which is why Netflix basically attempted to fine her $4 million for breaking her NDA. For scale, she says she made about $8,000 filming the show. So a $4 million fine is unhinged.
I didn't even know they made that much filming, honestly. I thought they weren't paid for filming.
It's about $1,000 a week, from my understanding. Mm. Her countersuit is basically asking the judge to determine that Love is Blind's NDA is both illegal and unenforceable. And she has some really heavy hitters on her side. One of her lawyers is Brian Friedman, who's worked with Bethany Frankel, Chris Harrison, Gabrielle Union, Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly, and many others. He has gotten a lot of people settlement money when they have been fired from their networks. So this case is actually pretty big. And if Renee wins, this could change the entire reality television genre, because a lot of it rests on these extremely restrictive contracts, these NDAs that might be deemed unenforceable. She's also not the only person to sue Love is Blind. And I can't help feeling like all of this is subtextual in the show as it airs. Like, you see it in the fact that contestants are allowed to break up before the altar, which isn't true for the first few seasons, but is true now because someone sued Netflix for false imprisonment because they weren't allowed to leave. You see it in the fact that they're constantly having food on screen because they were accused of plying contestants with alcohol and not feeding them, and that's why all this crazy stuff was happening. And so I wanted to get your take on this lawsuit. What do you think it means for us as scholars of reality television if Renee wins, if these NDAs are considered unenforceable across the board? I think it would cause a huge reckoning in the reality TV space.
Oh, for sure. I think, like, at the end of the day, and people may not often think about it like this, but this is a labor story. Mm-hmm. Like, there are all these unprotected types of labor that we have now, whether it's like reality TV stars, influencers, child influencers mm-hmm. who are essentially child stars, but don't have the same protections. And it's going to be a real question of like, okay, well, what protections do these people have? Because this is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. So I really think at the end of the day, it's a labor story. Like, you hear people talking about like reality stars, like, will they be able to unionize? Will they be able to do other things? And I think in the next 2 years, we're really going to see a lot of movement there. We're going to see how this all shakes out. And I would not be surprised if like reality stars, if it's like, all right, they got a SAG-AFTRA contract. They have XYZ. If companies want to be able to keep producing, keep doing things, they are going to have to really take it seriously, because what you don't want happening is someone being hurt or harmed or dying. And it's like, oh, now we have to take it seriously. It's better to be proactive.
Yeah. And I feel like this season in a lot of ways is the most proactive, or maybe the most reactive, to what has happened in between, in that I think this season was so good because of all the things that happened off camera, including this lawsuit, quite honestly, in that a lot of the early seasons drama came because they had to make it all the way to the altar, which meant a lot of the interactions just felt forced.
Yeah.
Versus now, where because they have been forced to respond to not wanting to be accused of false imprisonment, they're like, you can leave if you want. You just have to break up on camera, is allegedly what the rule is now. And I think that gave us some incredible moments, like Jimmy and Chelsea breaking up the night before their wedding. And so I'm really curious both about what this lawsuit is going to do to the show and to shows in general, and also if Love is Blind can capture the kind of magic they managed to capture in this season, or if they're just going to go back to what they did in the Houston season.
Yeah, everyone was very self-aware. And I think if they continue that self-awareness, even as the landscape changes, they will still have a winner on their hands.
A All right, that is the show. We will be back in your feed on Wednesday, so definitely subscribe. It is the best way to never miss an episode. Please leave a rating and a 5-star review in Apple or Spotify and tell your friends about us. Tell your Love is Blind contestants about us. Actually, if you know any Love is Blind contestants, please tell them about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com. ICYMI is produced by Sarah Spragley-Ricks, Candace Slim, and me, Rachel Hampton. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. See you online or on the Love is Blind subreddit.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.